Facebook itself can also send what we call significant and difficult decisions for review, like the decision on former President Trump. And again, we are bound by the board's decision.
Hi, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and this is Future Proof.
We wanted to do something a little different this week and do a deep dive on an important topic, Facebook. More specifically, the topic of content governance on Facebook, given that it is, for all intents and purposes, the modern public square. A while back, I read about Facebook's creation of an oversight board, almost like Facebook's version of a Supreme Court, so to speak, to help the platform make the right decisions on some thorny issues. And shortly after its creation, the oversight board was tasked with a somewhat famous decision, weighing in on Facebook's decision to ban then-President Trump in the aftermath of the January 6th insurrection. For this topic, I knew just who to turn to: Jennifer Broxmeyer, the Director of Content Governance at Facebook. I'm actually related to Jen. She's my cousin by marriage, but don't hold that against her. We talk about what the oversight board is, how it's autonomous from Facebook itself, the challenges of content governance at scale, how Facebook tries to have a fair appeal process for its users, and much more. I feel like there's a good chance you'll learn something today, so let's jump right in.
So, Jen, welcome to Future Proof.
Thanks for having me, Jeremy.
Yeah, no, it's really great to have you. I know we've been trying to get you on for a while. I think first things first, who are you and what do you do on a day-to-day basis?
Deep physical question, but I am, for my professional life, I lead the team that supports the oversight board from the Facebook side. And obviously, happy to get into much more detail about the oversight board. But there are 40 or so people working basically full-time on the Facebook side to make sure that the oversight board works, making sure that users can appeal to them, implementing the board's decisions. And so my team basically helps make sure everything works. And then I also spend a lot of time thinking about what is the future direction of the board. Is it actually creating meaningful change? Is it making things better for users? And we're still in the very early stages of the board, really thinking about long-term vision. And then in my personal life, I have two little kids. So I spend a lot of the weekend riding the Caltrain up and down the peninsula trying to entertain them.
Yeah, and I was just going to say, I feel like most of us who are parents did not necessarily imagine that they would have spent that much time with their young kids as much as we have. So I definitely feel your pain on the tough days there. I wanted to ask you, for those who are less familiar with the oversight board, what does it do and how is it run? And the reason why I wanted to ask that is I've been surprised to hear a few things that aren't necessarily accurate about the oversight board and what it's supposed to do from people that I would think would know this. I figured go to the source.
Yes, I don't know how to respond to the first part. I think I'm used to people not having totally accurate information about the oversight board. So I'm glad that you asked. So at its core, the board is about developing new systems of governance and new paradigms for free expression in social media. So it's clear, and I think basically everyone would agree, that the systems that we have in place now aren't working. And that's not just true for Facebook, that's for all social media companies, Twitter, YouTube. And I think even smaller sites are constantly dealing with issues of content moderation. And we just haven't figured out what the right governance systems are for a world where you can post something and millions of people around the world can see it and amplify it. And so the board itself is an independent body of 20 global experts in speech, journalism, human rights, and users can appeal decisions that Facebook makes on their content. So for example, if you, Jeremy, posted a picture of your kid and Facebook takes it down and says it violates our community standards, which are the rules that we have for what you can post on Facebook, and you disagreed, you could first appeal that within Facebook. And then if Facebook said, no, this picture needs to continue to stay down, we agree with our first decision, you can then appeal it to the oversight board. And if they choose it, can rule and have actually binding authority on Facebook. So if they told us we were wrong, put this picture back up, we are obligated to put that picture back up. Facebook itself can also send what we call significant and difficult decisions for review, like the decision on former President Trump. And again, we are bound by the board's decision. And so when we think about the board and the way that we designed it, there are three guiding principles. As I said, the first is that they have binding authority. So no one at Facebook can overturn the board. We've committed to complying with their decisions. The second is that they are transparent in their decision-making. So they announce publicly what cases they're accepting. They accept public comments on their decision, and then they issue publicly a decision that sort of looks like a court decision about what the trade-offs were, how they evaluated the case, and why they made the particular decision. And then the third critical principle is independent judgment. Facebook has set up in $130 million irrevocable trust that funds the board. There are trustees who themselves appoint and remove the board members. Facebook can't remove the board members once they're appointed. And then most importantly, I think just the members themselves come with their own reputation standing. Again, we have a Nobel Prize winner. We have a former prime minister, the former editor of The Guardian. The board is made up of people who bring a substantial amount of experience and independence.
Obviously, it's a challenge to find not just the best people, but also the people who are going to understand exactly what the oversight board is set up to do. So how do you align those two in selecting people who are going to make sure that they're essentially doing things that are in line, you know, with your vision for the board?
So first, I'll say once the board members have been selected, it is really their vision for the board. And I think there have been some instances of this where we set up the board expecting certain things, and it is very clear already. And again, I think you can recognize this as a parent. It's very clear already that they're very much their own institution. So Facebook selected the first 20 board members in partnership with the four co-chairs of the board. We are currently working with them to jointly select the next set of members to bring them out to their full number. And then after that point, we turn it over to the board and they are totally responsible for selecting future members. Things that we look for in members is obviously some kind of nexus to speech or experience in human rights, diversity of thought, experiences, culture, geography. So of the 20 board members, 5 are from the United States and the other 15 represent basically every single continent. And we're continuing to look for that. And I think one additional thing that we're starting to look for a little bit more is understanding of technology and an understanding of social media, amplification, automation, and bringing some of that sort of practical experience.
Which makes a lot of sense. How do you measure the ROI on the oversight board? Or maybe is that kind of too cynical of a question of Facebook trying to figure out exactly what the return is? Because I'm sure it's a major endeavor to set this thing up. And what key metrics do you follow to see if, you know, this experiment's working?
So I think probably unlike just about every other team, we don't have KPIs, but when we think about success, I'd say there are three areas that we're looking at. So first is users. Is the board making things better for users? And to be clear, this doesn't always mean agreeing with the user. And although the board has actually agreed with the users in the vast majority of cases, but it's really more about creating process and thoughtful, deliberative process for users. So that's one. The second one is it is about stakeholders and public dialogue. So are people learning more about how Facebook works because of the board? Are they learning more about how content moderation for social media at scale works? And then hopefully that creates a dialogue and a place where we collectively can better navigate these challenges. And then the third one is the impact it's having on the industry. So are we creating a sustainable model of self-governance when it comes to content moderation? And to be clear, Facebook has said, we think there is obviously a role for governments and regulation. So it's not that the board is meant to replace regulation. There are interesting questions, and obviously both parties have called for regulation. I think there are two things that we think about with regard to that. So one is, in the United States, at least, there are always going to be limits to what the government can do because of the First Amendment. And then two is, we tend to take a very Western-centric view of government role. But the truth is, Facebook also operates in a lot of countries where you wouldn't want the government sort of interfering, or where the government does interfere in very problematic ways in trying to suppress speech. So we're really looking for what is a better model of self-governance when it comes to industry. So as far as what we've seen, the board, again, has only been in operation really for 8 or so months. And they've made pretty significant impact. First, just by the fact that they exist, users can appeal to them, and we have reinstated content because of the board. But also, we've made much more significant changes around transparency and across our system. So for example, we published what we call our strike system, which is the penalties for what happens if you violate our community standards. We have translated our community standards, or will translate them, into additional languages. We have improved the way that some of our automation works to detect when nudity is used in health-related contexts. So for example, breast cancer education, to make sure we're not inappropriately taking down that type of content.
And I feel like there's a lot there, and some of which I want to come back to. But I know, obviously, one of the more famous cases, arguably the most famous, was the ban on the former president. And wondering if you can tell people what the particulars of that case were and how the oversight board handed things back to you, so to speak.
First of all, it's amazing because it feels like a lifetime ago at this point. But now that you say that and I think about it, it actually was so early in the lifespan of the board. I think the board had only been functioning for a month or two, and then we handed them this. But so on January 7th, we suspended then President Trump's Facebook account and Instagram accounts, given his posts praising the insurrection at the Capitol. And we applied a unique punishment for an unprecedented event, which is we suspended him indefinitely, but at least through the inauguration, so at least through January 20th. And after the inauguration, we referred the decision to the oversight board. We basically said, did we make the right decision? And then we also asked for their guidance and recommendations around how to think about suspensions or bans from Facebook when the speaker is a political leader. So on the one hand, when someone is a political leader, and certainly as powerful as the president of the United States, they obviously have outsized impact for harm. On the flip side, it's also incredibly important for people to see what their leaders are saying. And what we asked the board is, how do we balance those two things? The board accepted the case. We know that President Trump himself submitted a statement, although we have not seen it, but the board quoted from pieces of it in their decision. The board received 9,000 public comments weighing in on all sides. And then what they ultimately ruled in April was that we were correct to suspend him at the time, given the state of an emergency, given the clear praise of insurrection. But what they criticized us for, and I think rightfully, is that we couldn't have an indefinite suspension. We had to come back and create some kind of defined penalty. And they left open that could be putting him back on, reinstating him immediately. It could be banning him permanently, or it could be something in between. But we couldn't just make it up as we go. And so we took their decision, we took the guidance from their decision, and created a policy, which frankly, I hope we never have to use again, but meant for unprecedented situations where leaders advocate for or praise violence and violence of that nature, and came back and applied a 2-year suspension to his account, but also with the understanding that at the time, so in 2 years, we will look to see the conditions on the ground and confirm basically that it's safe for him to come back on. And I think what's been interesting in retrospect, and there's been some debate about, is on the one hand, we've subjected ourselves to this long protracted back and forth about what to do, and ultimately came back with the decision. I think probably from start to finish, it was 5 or 6 months. And we got raked over the coals in certain ways by the board. But on the flip side, when you compare what we did to what other companies did, they all unilaterally took the decision. So Twitter, the day of, permanently suspended him. YouTube has said that he's indefinitely suspended, but has given no guidance about what the conditions would be when they would state him or what that looks like. And so I think from our perspective, we held ourselves accountable and we gave up power to an oversight institution. And so, as you say, it certainly is the most well-known thing that the board has done, but I think also was a real sign that we believe in the board and we plan to continue to use them to hold ourselves accountable.
And I think also, obviously, to your point, the board was in its infancy then, so it makes sense that you wouldn't necessarily have a clear sense of how to deal with these situations that you really couldn't foresee. So, which makes a lot of sense, I think. Another thing that I had heard from somebody who I'm not going to name here, they had a bit of a lack of understanding exact ways that the board operated, and in particular said something about the fact that the oversight board has the ability to essentially amplify or de-amplify particular things on Facebook, which I feel isn't the case, but let me know if I'm wrong. And then also, should the board have more remit as you've continue along this experiment?
So we're still very much, as you said, at the beginning with the board. And the original remit for the board, which has actually already expanded quite significantly, was to take decisions on individual pieces of content. And we started with just content removal. So at the beginning, for the first few months, the board could hear cases about content that Facebook had been removed. And then a few months later, we brought into scope content that's been left up. So for example, if you post something and I think it violates one of the community standards, I flag it for Facebook and Facebook disagrees and says, no, this should stay up. I could then appeal your content to the board and say, I think this should come down. So that's been a pretty interesting area. The board is just starting to release decisions on those leave ups. In addition to that, one place where the board has had really its most significant impact, which we didn't really necessarily expect, is the board has the power to issue non-binding recommendations on cases. And at the time when we created the board, what we expected was the board would issue what we called policy guidance. So for example, it would say, your hate speech policy says this, we think you should actually also prohibit or allow this other thing. And we haven't gotten that. Instead, what we've gotten is, I think, 65 recommendations from the board about how to improve our content moderation more generally. So a lot of recommendations around increasing transparency. So for example, one piece of guidance was that we need to be more specific with users about the reasons we're taking content down. We need to explain certain things better in the community standards themselves. We should publish more data about when governments are asking us or telling us to take down specific pieces of content. And so in that way, the board is having really systemic impact. As I mentioned earlier, they had an early case where we mistakenly took down a photo for violating our nudity policy that was actually a piece of breast cancer education. In addition to restoring that content, we actually improved our classifier. As I said, in response to the board's recommendation about explaining to users more clearly why we remove content, we've started to build out, and in the US at least, and we'll expand to other countries, giving people much more specific information about why they violated our community standards. So again, early, but already the board is having impact on product and operations and other areas.
And I feel like the data transparency obviously builds trust. And there's a lot of data around that, obviously, that backs that up. And at the same time, I can't help but think, this is the cynic in me, about how it's difficult to scale things up when it comes to governance, given how much growth Facebook has across the world, but also all the other Facebook properties. And I would imagine that AI and automation have to play a significant role in your ability to essentially watch all these properties and make sure that you're at trying to get things right as much as possible and getting things down before they can do harm. I imagine it's a huge challenge.
Yes. One of the most interesting things from my perspective is to see that there seems to be a fair amount of skepticism by the board about automation. And I think probably that reflects a more general skepticism about automation. But we have 3 billion people that use our services. There are billions of photos, billions of posts and comments every single week. And we just couldn't operate without AI and automation. And as you said, it's the reason that we're able to take down certain types of harmful content actually before anyone even sees them. So a couple things on automation. One is, I think it's helpful to talk about the different ways that we use it, because I think sometimes people view it as a dichotomy of either you have human beings do it or you have automation do it. And the way that the systems work is much more complex. So we use AI and automation, as I said, to detect when content might be violating, but that is itself trained by people. We also use automation to prioritize when and how quickly certain things should go to review. So the vast majority of appeals go to a human being to review, but we basically have, as you can imagine, a queue of a massive number of things, and there are certain types of violations that are going to go to the top of the queue versus others. So things that might impact safety and or terrorism are going to go to the top of the queue. And then we also use it to amplify decisions that individuals make. So if a content reviewer says this particular thing violates, we can use the automation to find the thousands or millions of other copies of that exist on the platform and apply the same judgment. And I think one thing that I am constantly reflecting on is, and this is where it gets into, I think we just need new paradigms for speech online. There are times where there might be a right decision on a particular piece of content. And then there are times where there might be something that is right as a policy. So for example, one of the early cases the board heard was a user who posted a quote from the Nazi propaganda minister Goebbels. And first of all, thanks to my husband for insisting that I pronounce it somewhat correctly. The user posted it. There was no other context. It was just the quote. And so we removed it. We have a policy that says that you can't offer praise or support what we call dangerous individuals or organizations. The Nazis and members of the Nazi party are considered to be dangerous individuals. For example, you can't post praise of Hitler or Goebbels. And the burden is on the user to basically fall into an exception. So you are allowed to talk about dangerous individuals or, you know, Nazis if you're talking about it in a historical context, if you are condemning what they said. But in this case, the user just posted the quotation with no additional context. And so under our policy, we remove that. The user then appealed to the board and said, well, I meant this as a political commentary. And then President Trump offered sort of additional context about why it would have been clear to people who were friends with this user that it was meant as political commentary. The board agreed with the user and we restored that piece of content. And there's this interesting dichotomy where I think it is both correct in the individual case for that content to be restored. I think that was probably the right decision. But I also think it's correct, given the scale at which Facebook operates, to say, this is our policy. Where it is unclear, we are going to err on the side of removing, given the harm of praising or supporting dangerous figures. So again, our policies have to be able to operate at scale. They have to be able to work across billions of pieces of content, and they have to be relatively easy for reviewers to apply. Otherwise, it will either take them too long and we will miss critical things that should come down or present safety issues. And it will also lead to inconsistency. You may look at this and feel differently than I do. And a core principle is we should be as consistent as possible.
I feel like you're in an interesting position where darned if you do, darned if you don't, you know, where people are going to talk about the merits of doing the opposite of what you're doing at any given point, given how much power the platform has. And I'm wondering, how can you ensure consumers have the most fair appeal process, given the fact that each year a greater percentage of, let's say, overall speech is occurring on Facebook properties? And I imagine people have that natural kind of concern that there's this thing that I want to post on Facebook and Facebook might stop me. And again, a lot of these things are for good reasons, but on the rare occasion where there's something that somebody really wants to post and there is a legitimate reason and there's some nuance and it has to be reviewed. But like, how do you work on having an appeals process that is as fair to the user as possible?
I think you hit the nail on the head, which is we're never going to arrive at a place where 100% of people agree with the substantive decision of this content should stay up or down. So instead, the two interrelated things where I think the board, again, has already really pushed us and had impact is around transparency and process. So the ideal place that we get to is users know what the rules are, they know what they can say, what they can't say, and what the consequences are for posting something that's prohibited. And where they disagree with us, they have the ability to appeal that to someone who can take into account potentially more than we could on the first round. We are far from perfect, but Facebook is farther than just about everyone else. We have our rules published online. The vast majority of cases, users can appeal and they can usually appeal to a person. COVID has impacted that, but pre-COVID. But again, there's still a ways to go to this world where it's clear at the outset what the rules are. I think there are certain areas where we are much better at it than others, and they tend to be the places where it's more intuitive that you can't post certain things. I think some of the policy areas that are more challenging are ones that are just really culturally specific or where there's a lot of disagreement. So for example, hate speech, I think, is a policy that's just really challenging. It requires knowledge of context. Is this particular word a slur in a country? It may have one meaning in America and a different meaning in a different country. So all of that to say, I think the vision, again, is not one where everyone agrees with us, but they feel like we have a fair process to arrive at the decision.
No, I think that makes perfect sense. And just to leave you on some forward-looking thoughts, where would you like the oversight board to be in, let's say, 1 year? 5 years is very ambitious, given how nascent this whole experiment is. What does this look like if we're talking a year from now?
So I'm going to start with the loftier question, which is 3 years or 5 years or 10 years, which is this becomes the model. And that can look like a lot of different things. It could be the oversight board been somewhat close to its current form. It could be some other mechanism. But what we've started here becomes not just for Facebook, but industry wide, and has helped change the way that we have fair process and transparency and think about speech on social media. I think on the way to get there, the next year is obviously part of it is just more. So the board is really hitting its stride. So more cases, more impact, more thoughtful recommendations that make some of the changes that we've seen so far. Hopefully a couple more sort of juicy, interesting cases along the lines of the decision on Trump. I would love to see, again, in the next year, other institutions start to look to the board a little bit more. We've seen it a bit, but more of that, and potentially expanding into more areas at Facebook as well.
Well, I think that obviously it's got to be exciting to do such impactful work and to have such aspirations in terms of where this can go. And yeah, obviously, it's a really interesting space to follow the fact that there are all these things that are happening in an office, or I should say in a home office in California, that have the ability to impact so many things that people are doing online these days. This was really informative. Jen, thank you so much for making the time.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Jen for making the time. What came across to me in this conversation is a recognition that Facebook isn't perfect and knows it has work to do, which is refreshing considering the narrative in the media is, for better or for worse, generally pretty negative on Facebook. And it did come across to me that they're making some efforts to get things right. If you like what you just heard and this is your first time here, be sure to subscribe. Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Stitcher, the choice is yours. And if you're a longtime listener, please remember to rate and review Future Proof, as that's the number one way we get this show in front of people just like you. Special thanks this week to associate producers Jason Stack and V. Cortuccio. And why not, let's thank Eitan Kensky for marrying Jen years ago and adding her to the family. Once again, I'm Jeremy Goldman, and you've been listening to Future Proof.